Psychedelic Pod. With me, James Danny Paul. I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but before we meet her, let's have a word from one of our sponsors. You may have noticed that gold has been doing pretty well recently. In the last year, I think it's increased in value in sterling terms by around 50%. And if you'd bought gold when I first started recommending it on adverts like this, you would have certainly more than doubled your money. Now, a lot of you are probably thinking, is it too late? Have I missed the boat? Well, I can't definitively answer that question. Nobody can. But if I had to guess, I would say gold has got some way to go. And yeah, sure, there's going to be corrections, but you really ought to be owning physical gold for lots and lots of, not paper gold, obviously. You should be owning physical gold. Now, there are two ways of owning gold. Either you can actually own it, keep it in a vault or in your own home. There are risks, obviously, with keeping it in your own home. You know, what if burglars come, whatever. The problem with keeping it in a vault is that you then get paid a storage fee. But there is another way of owning physical gold and actually getting paid interest on it, unusually. And that is with a company that I've recommended before, and I use them myself. They're called Monetary Metals. Monetary Metals lets you earn a yield on your gold, paid in gold. Right now, you can earn up to 4% annual yield paid in physical gold ounces, not dollars or pounds. Instead of just storing gold and paying vault fees, your gold actually earns more gold over time. Monetary Metals connects gold owners with real productive businesses like refiners or jewelers that lease the gold. That's how they can pay interest, by the way. So they lease the gold and they pay yields back in gold. This is a way to compound your wealth in ounces of gold. There are no storage or insurance fees charged while your metal is earning yield. You can open an account with 10 ounces of gold and start earning yield right away. You stay in control, deploy how much of your gold you want into lease opportunities. In today's inflationary environment, saving in paper currency means losing purchasing power. Earning in gold means growing your real wealth. Go to the link in the description below, or go to monetary, that's monetary-metals.com/dellingpole/ to learn more about how to participate and start earning a return on honest money again with Monetary Metals. Tanya, honorary Dick, welcome back to the Delling Pod. It's always so lovely. You've filled my heart with joy, as you always do.
Oh,
and I like your drink. Show us your drink.
Oh. This one.
That is such a good drink.
The garden.
That is so much less wanky than my drink, which is just like, oh, yeah, I've got to rehydrate.
I don't like this.
Well, yeah.
Do you actually fill them with?
What?
What do you actually fill them with?
Filtered water.
So, as in, you have a filter, you're not just tipping in a bottle of Volvic.
No. Although Volvic is like a sort of poor man's Fiji water, isn't it?
Volvic.
It's got the stuff that gets rid of your Alzheimer's, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It gets rid of the aluminium, okay, According to experts.
Yes, we need more of them.
I wanted to apologise. That I'm looking so particularly rough today. I haven't shaved, which is always when I don't shave.
Okay, don't mention that. It looks like you have. It looks like you're still
It's always a sign that I'm slightly under the weather, and I have been. I've been going through quite a rough patch in that the broken finger has traumatized me slightly because I was so cavalier about it. I thought, yeah,
that's when we last spoke, James.
What?
When we last spoke, you'd just broken it, and I said to you, I hit my toe before Christmas. I thought it wasn't going to be a big deal, and it changed my whole life. And you said, oh, I just kept on riding, and now here we are all of these months later, and it's given you a terrible time.
It has. It really has. I was like, you know, because this is the attitude.
I was out meeting a friend, but in this light, it looks like I'm a drag act.
You're not a drag act. You're definitely not.
I know. I'd be rich if I was a drag act.
You could be. You could be like Margot Robbie, a very convincing drag. I don't think you are, though.
Do you know what, though? James, is this terribly wrong to say? But I saw this thing on Catherine Austin Fitz years ago, who I admire, Catherine Austin Fitz. She's obviously a phenomenal intelligence, etc. But yeah. I am, as you know, I'm conducting the experiment and not looking at anything. I'm going the other way to you. We should compare notes later. But years ago, when I was really into trying to find everything out, I just couldn't help but notice all of the symbolism in all of Catherine Austin Fitz's stuff. And I was a subscriber to her channel, and I wrote to her one day and I said, why are you using all of the symbolism, the children covering the eye, et cetera, et cetera? And she wrote back to me, which she didn't need to do because I'd have just assumed that she was too busy. And she said, oh no, the child is just looking into the future through whatever it was. And it was the most disingenuous response I'd ever read. It would have been much better to not respond to me, and then I would have assumed that she was a busy woman, which she must be. But because she lied to me, I cancelled my subscription. I said, well, this is very disappointing because you cannot possibly be in her position with her knowledge and then not know that you're using these symbols. But, and this is a terrible thing to say, I used to think that Whitney Webb was adorable. Mm-hmm. And I know I don't watch anything anymore, but you know, if you don't see the news for a long time, and then you walk into a room and someone's watching the news and you think, you laugh because it's risible.
Yeah.
And if you don't watch, I don't watch anything. So when I get my nails done and I see the pop videos, it doesn't look like music to me. It just looks like whoring. I'm just in a brothel, but a distasteful one. And because the whores in Paris, they're all out in the streets, but they've all got a better, you know, they're more chic than any star. And I haven't seen any of these characters for a while. And then the other day I saw Whitney Webb and I thought, does she look quite right to you? I'll just leave that there. It's like that chap that I the one who wrote these fantastic lectures, Grayson Perry. And we all say that Jimmy Savile hid in plain sight and that it couldn't be more obvious. But Grayson Perry is obviously aware that he's modelling himself on Jimmy Savile physically because he's an artist and he knows that he's physically modelling himself on Jimmy Savile. Because he can choose, he's choosing his look. So he's choosing to objectively model himself on Jimmy Savile in Balenciaga heels, when we all know that Balenciaga love child porn, and he put in one of his pots, I know where your child's dead body is buried. And I think, I love this man. I love his lectures. And he sews. Who doesn't want to sew? And I thought, but if you were trying to say something, how could you say it more clearly than that? Like Sam Smith with his, you know, filthy stuff. But whatever, it's probably all ironic, isn't it?
Tanya.
Morning.
You are on fire. Girl, you are on fire today. That's a fantastic, the way you just sort of bulldozed through my interesting talk about my thing, which is fine, by the way. We can come back to that. But I enjoyed that totally. Because weirdly enough, I've just been, hang on, I'm just going to get another book to make the thing higher because I'm trying to get my sit up straight. And if I, yeah, hang on, wait.
So thirsty.
We're going to use Carl Molantes' Matterhorn. That's quite a hefty book, so that should make it higher. Right, okay. Let's have a go.
Brace this up straight. It's my big mission
too. By weird coincidence, or not perhaps, because he's on TV at the moment, my one remaining normie toehold is my fortnightly TV column in The Spectator. And I keep having to sort of rein myself in to stop me dropping awake truth bombs for the
NASA truth pods.
Yeah. And I do slip in stuff. I have to say, in a naughty way. Well, I can't help it being naughty. But I did review the Grayson Perry, the new series where he has a go at AI. And
you see, I agree with that. Trying to get.
Yeah, you are. You are right that the some of these figures, be it Grayson Perry or Catherine Austin Fitz, they say some really cool stuff that actually you want to hear. And I'm not necessarily agreeing that you're right that they are the spawn of Satan.
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm just asking the question.
Well, it is a good question. It is a good question. And I'll give you another example of this.
Also, James, is it necessary? I do think in this particular instance, Catherine Austin Fitz is fully aware of what she's doing. I absolutely do. But there might be a, if you read anyone like Evola, they all say, even if you read Simone Weil talking about Osiris, everyone would say that before a culture becomes completely degraded, those symbols are pure. They only, the symbols themselves become degraded as the culture becomes degraded. And then they have a different meaning, like most things. But I just...
That's a very highfalutin argument. I mean, I one of my early tells like you probably in the early days of the revolution, you know, during the pandemic on the marches and stuff, I thought everyone was lovely. Everyone, all the awake people were just fantastic. No. They were just so good, no. And they were so trustworthy, and they were your best mates, and they, the light shined through them, and of course, since in the 6 years since, it's been a sort of slow awakening to the truth, which is that we are riddled with. Well, you can't trust anybody, really.
But James, and we are the controlled opposition, as in ourselves, when we start to put our faith in people, which is not where we should be putting it, we don't understand that even people are tools, that we sometimes will act as a tool to change somebody else, and sometimes someone will be a tool to change us. And it's because you're not supposed to idolize people. You're supposed to put your faith in God. You're supposed to love God first, and then your everything else will be okay.
Yeah, put not your trust in princes.
I'm not preaching. I'm not you. I'm just saying that when
do you preach?
Sometimes, but when you put your faith in the wrong places, you're going to suffer for it, just because nothing can withstand that. It's just not possible for the object of your idolatry, if you like. It can't withstand your worship. Nothing can. So all of those people are going to be pulled away. But the ones that are obviously put there for you to distract yourselves with, I would suggest are probably... what the hell is the point of Catherine Austin Fitz unless she's supposed to demoralise everyone and think that it's inevitable?
Also, she does come from Bloodline's stock. I suppose it's possible you come from Bloodline stock and free yourself, and but you,
like Prince
you
Harry, of,
yeah. Just
said,
briefly,
the point now, I,
there are lots of points I wanted to make because you're always skittering along to your new brilliant ideas, and I don't know, I can't keep up with you. But to your point, one of the in those early days when I trusted everyone and I thought, well, David Icke, he's the godfather. He's like, you know, he was there before the rest of us. He's when I looked at his iconic TV channel, and I noticed the dominant color was purple, and purple is the color of the Order of Melchizedek. It's the color of the Roman elites. It's
the color of your screen on my computer.
I can't help that. I cannot help that. I did not make it purple. Why would you, when you are constantly telling people about this? I mean, he has mentioned it before that purple is that. Why would you choose that as your background color? And in the same way, you remember that German the lawyer who was going to be Rainer Fulmich. He had these kind of Freemasonic black and white tiles in the background of his videos, and a suit of armor, which I think also means something Freemasonic. So it is as if they tell you. And the other point I was going to make you before you come back to one of your brilliant points is
I will just say this though, because don't let me forget, otherwise people will think I'm missing it. Alistair and I had a tour show in Bath.
Yes.
And in a theatre, the old Theatre Royal. Yeah. So I go to the theatre, and then Alistair calls me and he can't find it because it was in a Masonic lodge. The theatre is a lodge, a Masonic lodge. And the green room is a consecrated altar. And before Christ was a picture of a mason with a sword on. And everything was, it was a Masonic temple. And obviously quite a few people were very upset. And one lovely lady even wrote to me, and I responded to her honestly. I said, no, well, obviously we didn't know. You don't have a choice anyway. If it's booked through a festival, you get the venue of the festival. But also I thought I was going to the Old Theatre Royal, which I was. It's just a Masonic temple. And I said that probably, right, so the more interesting question would be if I'd have still taken the gig, because it was a really good deal. And I'm always curious to see inside these places. And when else would I ever have a chance to see a consecrated altar? And it was so interesting is that Alistair and I have performed in deconsecrated churches, which I do find uncomfortable. But I think it's amazing that the Masonic Lodge is happy to open up a consecrated altar for a performer. I think that that's interesting. Anyway, I said, obviously we wouldn't have chosen such a venue because it would be more insulting than ironic for our audience. But she didn't reply. So I don't know if she thinks that I'm... But there is, it's not, they're not hiding it. They're opening the lodges now. I don't know if this is a one-off or if we're supposed to see the symbol, not me personally, but if the public is now supposed to understand how beautiful it is, how, architecturally.
Well, they are Masons after all. They should be good at building.
Well, they only became the dodgy ones once they incorporated the non-builders in the Protestant, in time of Protestantism. We discussed this last time.
We did. They must have a few builders left over, though, maybe.
Back to Mason Perry.
No, not back yet. I want to know when Alistair particularly, when he went into this Masonic temple to Satan, was it a bit like that when Damien in The Omen goes into the church? Did Alistair start sort of fizzing?
Well, he was surprised. And then when he came in, I said to him, look, there's a chap in front of Christ who isn't Christ.
Yeah, hang on, somebody's come.
Oh, I'm not going to not look at myself. I'm going to
look at myself. I don't know. Oh, I don't know. Have a look if you want. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So he asked me if he should move. There were so many interesting symbols in the chapel. He asked me if he should move the picture as a joke. So that this other chap wasn't on the altar. And I said, I don't think Christ needs you to defend him here, you know, because I just don't think it's necessary. I think he just takes these things as with a pinch of salt, Alistair. He would have not have chosen to be in a Masonic temple, and he went and took the piss out of it, but we didn't choose it. It was just a weird thing. He's very Tout en place. He's in his assiette. You know how he's not worried about.
Yeah, he's happy in his skin. He's comfortable. He's.
He didn't like it, and he said he didn't like it, but he's not going to melt.
No, and I think God understands that. I think God's not going to be thinking what.
I actually thought he looked more uncomfortable in the church.
Sorry.
I think he looked more uncomfortable in the church.
What, in the deconsecrated church?
Because he doesn't believe that you should be able to deconsecrate a church.
Yeah.
And if you think that a church is holy, then it's a strange place to be telling jokes.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's always weirder to do it in a church.
So I was just going back to one of the many varied points we've been making. Because I have to do TV reviews, I have to watch a medium that I increasingly find really discomforting because it is programming and you can see it. You can, once you, like the other day, my TV does a thing where it comes on and it's already playing a particular channel, which I don't watch necessarily. So sometimes I come in and it's playing EastEnders. And I haven't watched EastEnders since Dirty Den was in it and Dot Cotton. What's her name? The woman with the pug.
I know you think I'm a woman, and I always interrupt because I am and I do. But when I was a child, my friend, she lived in the pub in our village, and I had a play date at her house, and it was time for EastEnders to come on, and I said, "Oh, but I'm not allowed to watch EastEnders," and she went, "All right, bye." So I went home, and I knew then, and I didn't mind because I understood that she definitely preferred the television to me. But when I got older, I really didn't understand. I know I talk about this a lot, but I think that the television is evil, and I think it completely disrupts the ecosystem. So at school, the children are shown television. They trust these people. I've had to explain to my children that David Attenborough isn't some sort of god, because they're shown him at school and they're celebrating his birthday. Why? They're going to celebrate his birthday in the church, and my son has written a letter, and the whole school gets to go in fancy dresses and endangered animals to celebrate his birthday. And my son's really proud of himself because he did this thing on birds, and now the whole school gets to. But what I'm trying to say is that when I had to explain to them that he makes stuff up, I read to them about the polar bear, you know, the fake photo fetish from the zoo and stuff, because
And the walruses.
Yeah, and my child said was, he said, but I thought that he made up the truth. I said, yes, you got it exactly right. He makes up the truth. But the point of all of these characters, even if you don't watch them very often, is that especially when a child sees them, a child starts to trust an animation. A child starts to trust an actor. An actor walks into a room and everybody behaves strangely. It's like when you travel in somewhere like Thailand and the whole system is being corrupted by the fact that the prettiest local girls are being sold to tourists. So the whole family unit is disrupted. Everything is disrupted. Television destroys everything. But it wasn't until I was a grown-up that I've realised that it's exactly the same now. I'm not sure anybody loves me more than the TV. I know that my mother definitely loves the television.
Tanya, I love you more than I love the TV. And I even love it when you interrupt me, because you always make cleverer points than I was going to make. But sometimes I can nevertheless get my points in
a bit.
So I was watching... I watched about maybe 30 seconds of EastEnders, and you've got this character saying, I've just been looking at my social media recently, and have you seen these? Have you seen what the far right's up to?
What's happened?
What? What's happened? I don't know. Are you frozen? Did you just freeze then? You froze on me, didn't you?
You literally tried to speak. My computer went off. You can try again, Magic.
So we know now that the purpose of soap operas is propagandizing of the TV watching classes. I was watching last night. I was watching this supposedly classy drama, in which the Scottish guy who was in the thick of it. What's he called? Who was in the thick of it? You don't watch TV, so you don't know.
That's a long time ago, the thick of it. There was that chap, Chris Langham, who liked the kids.
No, not him. Oh, what's his name? I think he was Doctor Who as well. He was Doctor Who.
You've lost me.
He's a good actor. I met him at a party. I met him at Charles Sarch's house, weirdly enough.
Ooh.
And he's lovely, lovely bloke. What?
Was that a good party? Did anyone get throttled?
It was good. No, well, I mean, I used to be mates with Charles. He was great. I mean, this was in my normie days. What's he called? It'll come back to me, the name. Anyway, so this is a sort of another of those sort of police series where there's sort of these mismatched characters. And there's this woman who is the doughty police woman officer who is half black and half white. Oh. and there's the baddie is played by the Doctor Who guy, and the Doctor Who guy is great. He's really good at acting, as good actors are. They do good acting, and the series is being praised, of course, because praised for its grimy authenticity and its dispiriting shots of a dystopian London and et cetera, but you look at the messaging that is going on underneath the good acting and the good direction and the nice shots, and the storyline is basically, yet again, white people are bad, They are corrupt. They are racist. The hero, one of the heroes in this guy is this black guy who's been wrongfully arrested for a crime he did not commit. And there's his nice son who's a very decent black kid who's going out with a white girl. And I don't want to sound like sort of Alf Garnett here, but you can see how in the guise of intelligent entertainment and police drama, the audience is being programmed into certain positions. And that's what the program was really about. The storyline is irrelevant. The acting is just a distraction. We are being programmed to think that there was no such thing as being English, we've always been a melting pot. I mean, you see it more obviously in programs like Bridgerton, which recreates Jane Austen's England, only as if there were the same kind of diversity ratios as there are today. So every other character is black.
When you say half black or white, though, you still mean mixed colour, don't you?
Yeah, I do. My
son was given a book for his birthday, and in it, it's called Weird and Wonderful Creatures. And one of the creatures in it, so weird and wonderful that you very rarely see it, James, there's only a few in the world, was a lobster that was split down the middle, half blue and half red. And this is supposed to be a half male and half female lobster. That's
what
obviously
is half cooked and half not cooked is what it is.
It's obviously completely cooked up fabrication lie, because even if there was such a thing, it wouldn't be so straight down the middle. It's a nonsense. But I think the whole idea of pretending that it's very narcissistic to make everybody think that a relationship should just be about their own perception of another person. It's the whole storyline is basically what do you call it when you make something? It's a glorification of the foreign whilst pretending that the foreign isn't foreign. Because obviously in London, it's a completely different environment if you actually live here to if you live out in the sticks. So the only time I've ever been told off for one of my jokes about my own relationship, which is my former previous relationship, which was with an Indian Irish man, when I was out in the sticks and I did that joke, there was a girl at a hen do there who'd just been doing sex charades on stage. She was hammered, but she became completely hysterical when I made a joke about my own marriage. She stood up and she started screaming. And
did she?
Yeah. She said, oh, I can't listen to this. You're Islamophobic. You're racist. And I should have just said, I am pretty racist, but I think it's white people I don't like, and it might just be you. You know, I should have come back with something in my character, I thought to myself later. But at the time, at the time, I was so confounded. I came out of my character and I said, are you saying I can't make jokes about my own marriage? But then you make it a philosophical question, because I wasn't making jokes about my own marriage. I was just making jokes. They weren't actually about my marriage. They were jokes about race. I just think that this thing, especially for people that are just watching the television, they are getting overexcited about themselves. They're getting overexcited about their parents and what their neighbours think about someone in London that they haven't visited. It's all a nonsense. The fantasy is to make people refuse to see what's actually around them. It corrupts, that kind of programming corrupts your relationship with your own friends and family, because you start to think that they're, and I hear this literally everywhere I go, that people complain that there's not enough diversity in their area, as if it's not enough sourdough bread or not enough variety of you know, fruits and vegetables in their corner shop. They literally, the way they're being fed this stuff through the television, it's as if people are a product that should just be available in their area to make their area more interesting and more normal. It's really, I've got to stop doing this. My son keeps doing it. So I think it's obviously programming, yeah. But why do we imagine that people on our side, like Catherine Austin Fitz, why do we imagine that someone like that would be given that kind of platform with those kind of contacts? those kind of resources and not also be there to program us. If you look at our side, what did we have that other people didn't have during the vaccine campaign? We had different things. Some of us just instinctively didn't want to be told what to do. I think that was it. Some of us thought it was deeply, profoundly immoral or didn't like the way other people were behaving. Some people just weren't frightened. They weren't frightened for their own health. But how would you corrupt those people? You would just switch things around, as in how would you corrupt us? You would just give us new heroes to gossip about. You'd just poison our well, basically. You haven't poisoned our body, so how would you poison us now? You would poison us by constantly telling us there's about to be... What did they do in that period to get everybody to take the vaccine? They took away their things and they took away their social approval. And what are people like Catherine Austin Fitz telling us every single day? They're going to take away all your stuff and you won't be able to go anywhere and you won't have social approval. So we're being fed every day this idea of affliction that we should be prepping for, but we're putting all of our energy into the wrong scenario. No one's saying, it's so fantastic if you grow your own fruit and vegetables, have your own local... I mean, people are saying that too, but... Mm-hmm. The overriding message is that this is the apocalypse, as if there haven't been 1,000 apocalypses before, and as if people right now aren't living their own personal apocalypse. There are millions of people right now who are having everything that they could possibly have taken away from them to come closer to God. It's not going to have to be all organized by the powers that be. I don't see why it has to be like that. I think everyone's going to be on an individual journey. I think we're being misguided. I don't think we're being encouraged to be stronger. I don't know.
Ruminate on that. Just come back briefly to my finger because I wanted to tell you about my finger story. So I've been feeling manky because I've been having this homeopathic treatment, and it's peeled back the layers of the onion, and it seems to be taking me back to my early kind of conditions. Like I used to get bad eczema. And my eczema's really come back. It's all over me, back of my legs, and it's really annoying. And I'm sure the finger thing has not helped. And
Do you smell eczema cream? No.
Well, what is eczema cream? I'm using calendula and graphites or graphites. I'm not sure. Wife wants me to go to a dermatologist, but I just think, well, actually...
No, they don't smell of eczema cream.
Yeah, well, probably, and also the skin is a manifestation of an inner problem, so I need to resolve the inner problem. I won't tell you the demon story because I've told it on another, nor the curse story, which I've also told on another podcast. I can't remember which. But I went. This is the new information. So the last time I went into hospital,
listen to your podcasts.
I had a horrible minor operation where they immobilized my arm and they shoved this wire through the tip of my finger with a little hook on the end and down the middle of the broken bone. And there's a little hook on the end, like Cut Price, Abu Hamza's dick joke. And they leave it there for 4 weeks. Anyway, I went in 2 weeks ago to get the wire taken out. And the consultant was like, "Oh, this doesn't look right. Doesn't look like it's still wobbly. It doesn't look like it's mended." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" And he said, "Well, could be a really, you've had the nasty operation. Now you could have to have a really, really nasty operation where involving bone grafts and all sorts of complicated horror." And I was really bothered about this. And I put out a special message asking all my listeners to pray for my finger. And I want to say to all those who prayed for my finger, thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart, because I went in yesterday and The guy was actually quite surprised. I think he had been really expecting the worst. And he said, oh, I think it seems to be, well, I don't remember what the technical term was, it seems to be knitting. And he said, it's not 100% clear from the x-rays yet, because this is early days, but I think that you're finally on the mend. And I'm thinking, thank you, God, and thank you, everyone. Because have you noticed that one of the things about, even though that God is omnipotent and all that.
Have you been smoking?
Well, what do you mean by have I been smoking? I mean, you mean how many have I been smoking, or have I given up, or what?
It can affect apparently the bones healing. I don't know, but my toe just never.
Yeah, they love that. They love telling you that because they don't want, because well, they're programmed to tell you not to smoke for whatever. Yeah, I mean, well, stop that. I don't. Do you know what? I remember the day when one of my best smoking friends, Ewan Ferguson, stopped smoking, and that was about. That was shortly after university, and I never really forgave him for that.
Okay.
And people who give up smoking, it's not a good thing. I think it's like you've decided to leave the gang.
Well, I don't know. I gave up for 12 years, then I started again, thinking I could be one of those part-time smokers that I'd always found so attractive. It turns out I couldn't.
I'm one of those. You obviously find me attractive. I am much a part-time.
Yeah, but right now, James, I just actually want to go and sit down on the bench and smoke 20 in a row.
I smoke two a day.
Yeah, I can't do that.
Does that make me a smoker? I mean, by French standards, I wouldn't be. Anyway, just briefly, back to the power of prayer. This seems to be, I didn't make these rules, but God seems to have made these rules, like where he goes, I can help you because I'm God and I'm omnipotent, but my task is made much, much easier when you ask me for stuff, and or maybe en masse you ask me for stuff. I don't know how it works, what the deal is, but it seems to be the deal. Have you noticed that?
Well, the deal is faith, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the mechanism. Why is it given that God could do anything?
When you ask for something sincerely, you're showing your faith. When you need something, you're not showing your faith. You're just showing your need. It's a different thing.
But why does God need you to show your faith in order to be able to help out?
Well, I don't think that he needs you to. It's just that you're open to help. You're more open, aren't you, when you have faith? Because you're cleaner. So it's like creativity. When you're creating something, the things that you make when you're at your best are part of the divine flow. They're not. They don't come of you. They're not of you.
They don't. And that's true.
I was thinking a lot about this in terms of Narcissus, because I thought, if the divine flow is like water, what really happens when Narcissus catches sight of himself? He just mistakes himself for being the source of the divine flow. So he becomes enamored with himself. And it's a bit like when you create something and you start to think it's you, and you don't realize you've just briefly partaken of the divine flow, and it's not yours to own. I don't mean that I'm not annoyed if someone nicks a joke. Of course I am. I don't mean it like that. I just mean that you understand that you have access to something, and you have access to it the purer you are in your heart. And some people only have access to the people that have access to it, which is why some people are parasites on you. I've really been thinking a lot about this before. I talked to you about it last time, that you can accidentally be a parasite on your children because they are obviously pure. And you can accidentally be a parasite on other people because they have access to a flow, and if it's strong enough in them, you can participate in it. But really, everyone should go to the source, and the source is not the individual. That's why AI is so perturbing. So this is really silly and vain, but Alistair and I are doing some shows that we need to sell tickets for in Chesham, Leeds, and somewhere else. I can't remember. It's on my website. So I thought, well, I need to just send out an email with a clip. And so I suck up a clip because I'm writing new jokes. And I suck up a clip, and then I thought, well, it turns out that if you turn it into a short, this YouTube format, YouTube automatically promotes it. So instead of getting 100 hits in a month, it gets 1,000 hits in 10 minutes. But the short format is really ugly. It really zooms in on you. Anyone normal wouldn't like it. You're not supposed to be seen that up close. You're not supposed to see anybody up that close. I don't take a photograph up your nose. Why would I bother? And I was looking at it thinking, this is really horrible. And it's all part of this push towards having everybody use filters, programs, plastic surgery, you know, all of these animations, because people don't want to look at themselves in the way that they're being presented when they're sharing their work with their physical body. A friend of mine, she's very successful. She's just had another facelift. And our mutual friend said, oh, well, she's really pleased with it. And that's all that counts. And I thought, that's the only thing that does not count. That's what does not matter. The fact that she cannot stop putting shit in her face and thinks it's better doesn't mean that that's fine. It means that that's a disorder. It's the face of communism. You know, this, everybody's supposed to look the same. In God's creation, there isn't one leaf that is the same as another leaf. But in our version of creation, we all are morphing into one person with one stretched plastic head. And that's the only thing that looks good in the way that things are formatted and promoted online by the algorithm. I'm getting to the point where I'm probably going to lose even my smartphone. Because they've, do you know what they've done now, James? They've taken the timetables off the bus stops and put a QR code.
They haven't.
They have.
I hate them so much. Cool. Sorry, Tanya, before I forget, can I tell you another thing I hate? I suddenly remembered. Okay. I'm now much, much more in with the farming, the farming community than I used to be, because I'm no longer an incomer now. I'm accepted by them because of church and hunting, basically. And so I get my eggs from one of the farmer people. I mean, I should have my own chickens, but that maybe. And we give her all our old egg boxes. And have you noticed when you go to eggs, since forever have been sold in what quantity? By the dozen, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the half dozen. That is the natural way that eggs in the middle. If you had a groat, you could probably have gone to buy them in the Middle Ages, couldn't you? A groat was probably worth quite a lot. But you would have bought your eggs in dozens and half dozens. And so we took these old egg boxes and I bought three dozen eggs. And I came back with two eggs short. Do you know why?
No.
Because of those bastard posh eggs that one buys from Waitrose, that they've got this new thing where they sell them. It's shrinkflation. They sell them in boxes of 10. So it feels like a box of a dozen eggs, but actually it's only got 10 eggs in it. And you think, oh, that looks better value than this box or that box. And I'm thinking, who was the bastard who invented this thing, this shrinkflation trick to play on us, selling boxes of eggs in boxes of 10, which they were never meant to be? And we're talking about the Burford Browns. Who does Burford Browns? That company. You know the ones? Or yeah. Burford Buffs, maybe. But the point is, you've got this high-end egg company playing this dirty trick on you.
You know what's actually happened here? This is like Dominic Frisby's description of those men being sent out to measure the distance somewhere and getting mugged and robbed and everything else. And then they come back with a metric system, which is a lie. So the furlong, everything is to do with the human body. And 10 is just going to the metric. Napoleon's got your eggs, James. That's what's happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's my rant over. So Burford Brown people, you are, whoever thought of that, you are going to burn in hell. I guarantee it. Right, carry on. Tell me about your thing that you were talking about before I interrupted you.
I don't know what I was talking about. You were telling me about Grayson Perry.
That was ages ago. How did we get onto the subject of eggs and egg box sizes and things?
Well, I think you should buy a dozen chickens. I actually think that I should move to the countryside. I went horse riding the other day, James.
It's called riding. Sorry.
Not the way I do it.
Horse riding is common. It is, because the response is what do you think you're going to be riding? Elephants?
Bicycle? Yeah.
How was your riding session? What was it?
It was very slow. It was in Hyde Park.
What was your horse called?
Global warming is a massive con. There is no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition of my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011, actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era, the era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that way. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
That was ages ago. How did we get onto the subject of eggs and egg box sizes and things?
Well, I think you should buy a dozen chickens. I actually think that I should move to the countryside. I went horse riding the other day, James.
It's called riding. Sorry.
Not the way I do it.
Horse riding is common. It is. Because the response is, what do you think you're going to be riding? Elephants?
Bicycle? Yeah.
How was your riding session? What was it?
It was very slow. It was in Hyde Park.
What was your horse called?
A horse.
Did they not tell you its name?
Well, James, they might have done, but I've never been.
Did they not say, you're on so-and-so? I mean,
I meet so many people after shows, I only remember faces. I remember this horse's face. It was very long. And I took my children, but it's too slow. When I went horse riding in New Zealand, I assumed it would be like this hotel experience I'd had with a friend. She didn't have a plus one and she was going to some corporate do with her law firm. So I went along as her, you know, guest. And we rode horses there. And they were so slow that she was chain smoking on while she was horse riding. Now, this is ridiculous because they wouldn't let you go.
I do that when I'm galloping. I stick it between my lips and just go, because sometimes you stop for a fag.
I butt break your finger.
There's a story about that, but basically, ooh, I had it. It just sticks to my lips, and because you, it's such a faff trying to smoke a rollie while you're hunting.
Oh, in life, generally.
Getting it into your pocket and trying to get it out, and if the hunt takes off, what do you do? You don't want to lose the fag, so you just clamp it. It looks quite cool, but anyway, sorry, carry on.
What I mean is that you're already allowed to trot, and then when I was in New Zealand. And I went horse riding thinking it would be just the same and I wouldn't be allowed to go at a high speed. You were just stuck on a mountain and just sent off. And with actual ground where the horses are stumbling and you don't know which bit to hold on to. It's not for me. I'm going to have to learn how to drive again, James. I just think that the city is not going to be for me for much longer. Not because I don't love it and it's so handy and everything's here. but because it's closing in. I was in Oxford Street the other day and they were doing a facial recognition technology experiment. And there were so many police there. And I said to one of these policemen, I said, what's going on? And he said, oh, it's a facial recognition check. We do it. We're working on this technology and we do it every so often. And I said, well, what if you think this technology is evil and you don't want to be a part of it? And he said, well, then you have to write to the government, I suppose. And I saw the other day that it's... I said, okay, thanks.
Dear government.
Yeah. Well, but they're bringing this in and it's going to be... I went in a supermarket the other day with, and it said that as you walked in, this is facial surveillance. So the system is here and I'm not sure I want to live in it. I love the city. I'm wondering if it would be better. I'm in a complicated situation because of my family arrangement. Or I'd move abroad. I've always said that you should stay where you are and live in your own land. But I don't think that things are going to happen immediately. And I do like cities, but it's quite corrosive, I think, to see that the facial recognition system is already here in my city. And the beauty is being eroded on an almost daily basis. And something really strange happened. Oh, it's the same thing as when I said, if you don't see any of this stuff and then you hear it, for some reason, I was somewhere the other day and I heard an advert. It's the television, by the way, is coming in everywhere now. People watch it on the tube next to you or on the bus without headphones. They think that you should suffer their rubbish.
Yeah.
And they're on in, you know, every pub. And in Southampton, the whole high street is screened, ugly place. And but anyway, I heard this advert the other day because obviously, you know, the theory that there is no lottery to win.
No, I like that.
So I heard this from my friend and I thought that it makes sense to me and I agree because the lottery is obviously just a dream catcher. Because if this idea of Simone Weil's is that any kind of study is to increase your attention, your faculty of attention, so that you can pray better. What is this, the secular prayer? So I meet people all the time, they're praying for something, but they're not often as specific as you. When you prayed for your finger, it was quite specific. So sometimes people are just very general. They just want to feel better. Or they want people to be okay. But we don't actually know how people will be okay. Maybe someone will be okay through immense, intense suffering. And maybe someone else will be okay by, you know, having a great stroke of luck. You don't really know what's better for somebody else. So, and when you pray, you don't really know what you're asking for unless it's something obvious, like, please fix my finger. And but if you look at the lottery as a secular version of prayer that we've been encouraged to displace our attention to because our new God is money, or our current God is money, money and science, which is the same thing, then people can't really even articulate their lottery fantasies anymore. It's been with us for so long. Someone said to me recently, I don't think the lottery would be enough to sort everything out. So because it's become so vague, they can't work out what they want. And I actually think it's quite a Bolshevik idea. It's like this, Elon Musk said it the other day. He said, everyone's going to have universal high income. You cannot have universal high. You can only have, you can't level up. You can't have universal high. You can only have variety or slavery. There's no equality. There's slavery or variety. But I was thinking that the whole idea of the lottery is basically that you can take yourself out like a usurper of your own situation and just take something that you haven't earned, don't really understand and don't know what to do with. And that's why the lottery stories that we do hear are often about someone blew the lottery, but because they wouldn't have known what to do with it, but that's feeding this desire that we have to basically go into someone's house and take it. It's not that we don't want a universal high anything. People just want to take something from their neighbor. No one's trying to take the horrible place on the corner so that they're just like their neighbor. That is literally called giving your goods away and following Christ. People want to take the house on the corner away that's big and has all the land and ideally some servants. And even the prospect of doing things for themselves puts people off. That's why a one-bedroom flat in Belgrave Rover is worth about 58 million times more than a huge castle in Scotland, because no one wants to live in Scotland and have to do their own work and till their own land. But everyone would like to have a one-bedroom flat in Belgravia and a daily facial. I got lost there talking shit. I haven't
I was just thinking that that's another example of what TV does. You're talking about lottery winners and stuff. It has become
That was the whole point I was trying to make. Sorry, I got distracted by myself.
Mm.
So I heard this advert about the lottery and it said, it's a conspiracy. It said it in the advert. And then someone else said, no, it's not. It could be you. And I thought they've taken the correct fact that there is no lottery and they put it into the advert as a conspiracy theory.
They have to tell
you. This is why if anybody finds out you're an anti-vaxxer now, one of the first things they say is, and what's your position on dinosaurs? And you know this chemtrails thing? Apparently, my friend Jody says that they've turned it into a kiss, a love kiss. So now people are sharing it on Instagram when they see a chemtrail in the sky. Instead of saying, what is this? Stop poisoning me. They're like, hashtag, I love you.
They're so evil. I love them.
They're really funny, though. I think fair play. They're so amusing.
They're brilliant. They are.
So explain that then, James. If the devil only copies.
Yeah.
Which I do think, that's why all of the buildings are so ugly and the faces are so ugly and the ideas are actually at root so ugly. And that's why lying is so ugly, because sometimes the truth isn't what you would like it to be, or life presents something to you in a way that you weren't anticipating, or you have your own idea of yourself has changed in a way that takes some adjusting to. But the truth itself is a good thing. Because it requires the adjustments that you need to move through things, I think. And obviously, most of the bad stuff is just circumventing the problems that you're supposed to overcome. You just sort of skip around them or hedge them.
Or defer them.
Yes, or put them off, exactly. Or hope that something, you know, saves you from them. But nothing will. Because they're there to teach you something, annoyingly. But how is it that they're so funny if they're not creative?
Well,
is it just mockery?
I don't know. Hang on a second. I think one might laugh mockingly and sarcastically. I'm not really thinking. There's something very counterfeit and manipulative. It doesn't feel right in what one's bones. It's what they're doing is dishonest, creepy. So I'm only sort of applauding them in a kind of slightly cynically amused way, but I'm not really thinking, hey, great guys, you're really witty.
I am a bit.
You are. But okay.
I'm not sure if it's just.
That's your dark heart, Tanya. You basically.
Maybe I do think it's, or maybe I just think it's funny when you're shown how easy people are to manipulate. Don't forget, James, that my whole crisis in this period of time, which hasn't stopped, is that I've always been able to get my own way. And ever since this began, everybody has a personal experience that they've had in this period that's separate to the obvious horror. I'm talking about your own personal development, which I keep hoping that I've achieved, but apparently haven't. I always had my own way, even when I didn't deserve it. And in the whole COVID period, I was right. Every time I said something would happen, I was right. It wasn't that I was making it about myself. I was actually genuinely talking about moral principles that I separated from myself. I gave examples. I tried all of the, you've frozen. Have I frozen? Have you gone? You've gone. You've gone. That's not me, James. That's you. Oh, dear.
Oh, blimey. Come on. Don't try and reconnect. Ah, I'm back.
Hello.
Do you know what that was? Some...
What?
Some idiot, possibly me, or possibly that man who came in, or heaven knows who, had unplugged the lead that puts my laptop into the wall, so it suddenly ran out of battery. I'd like to say it was demons, but it wasn't.
No. I was just fiddling around. I hope that wasn't filmed, though. I never look at myself.
No, I don't know. We can always edit it out. Can you remember what we were talking about?
Well, yeah, you took your revenge on me when I started ranting. I said that everybody has, separate to the bigger picture, everybody has their own personal experience of this, which is separate to the fact that we realise that the world is not as we see it. And for me, my personal thing has been my whole life, I got my own way.
Mm.
Not when I necessarily deserved it or ought to have had it.
Mm.
I could just persuade people to come round to my way of thinking. It didn't matter what it was. I got everybody caught smoking on the school ski trip and then ended up looking like a hero between the teachers and no one got reported. I just had the gift of verbiage. I just could talk shit and get my own way. And that was my thing. And when this started, I spent months researching, making sure that I wasn't wrong. I tried to be wrong every day. I was reasonable for the first time in my life. I could see that it was evil. I said that things would happen and then they actually did. I tried everything. I was really sincere. I tried tears. I wasn't even trying. This is for the first time in my life. I sincerely appeal to people's reason, their moral faculties, a good friend of mine, he was not interested. And I said, it doesn't matter that you're not in, sorry. Oh, just ignore it. It doesn't matter that you're not interested, I said. It's not your battle to fight, and that's fine. But don't make it harder for me. So you don't have to do anything. Just don't make it harder for people like me that are saying no. But all of those people did make it harder for people like me. Because part of them pretending that we weren't telling the truth was to make it, that made it harder.
Is it burglars?
Yeah.
Because it's London. No, it's, I mean, just it's likely right. You're being
someone attacked. Someone tried to post, but I can't be doing it. Anyway. So all of that period, even when I was right, nobody agreed with me. Nobody changed their behavior. And afterwards, nobody said sorry. In fact, the weirdest thing happened to me this year. I have one friend who's been my friend despite being very successful on the circuit and despite fundamentally disagreeing with me. But we've been friends for so long that he's been super supportive, regardless of the fact that we had different ideas. And essentially, at its heart, he doesn't think I'm fun anymore, because once you see the world the way we do, it doesn't really matter if you're drinking champagne or if you're moaning. If you're not looking at the same gods, if you're not excited about someone's TV breakthrough, you're not excited about their holiday, or you're not excited about, and you're just not excited about the same things that they are. You might be laughing in the same way, you might be speaking in the same way, but essentially the things that they're thrilled about aren't the things that you're thrilled about, and you're no longer good company for that milieu. And I got a really, to be fair to him, a well thought out and very amusing explanation of why the choices I'd made with the people I work with and the projects I've done over the last few years, I can't expect to keep my friends. Now, obviously, I've got all my same friends from school and my same friends from college and university regardless, but I suppose this is my last friend who was also a colleague who has said, I've just got to accept that's not a laugh.
This is why you need to move to the country, because you don't need friends. Oh, like that.
Well,
anyway.
I think lots of people don't need friends, but I do. And
you can forge a new life. You'll find things are sort of more real. Dead lamb.
I'm not complaining in that way. My best friend from when I was 12 is still my best friend. I don't mean it like that. I just mean that. It turns out all of the things that I thought were my skills that enabled me to articulate myself to people, to bring them around to a different opinion, or even just to accept that I had a different one, those things don't work. So the people that really love you, that are on the other side, they just accept that you're a bit strange and they've decided to let it go because of friendship. For other people, it's uncomfortable because it implies things about their own position in the workplace that they don't want implied. But for me personally, I've had to completely let go and accept that there are things that I think will be, that ought to be for me, and they're not. And I'm not going to be able to get out of it. This is the reality.
Well, you've kind of been born again. That's the thing. Yeah, I mean, I think that the process of becoming awake is a bit like the process of becoming Christian, that you sort of reject the world, the material world, because you know that it's all lies.
But you can't really reattach to anything, because there's the most amazing. Have you read Simone Weil yet, James?
No, clearly I should.
I really think you should. But she wrote about the Lord's Prayer, and she said that this is back to the energy thing that I'm so obsessed with. Oh my God. And the hilarious thing is, because I'm a woman And
you are women. You're all woman, Tanya.
Yeah, but it's a problem because of other women. And they often, some of them are geniuses like Simone Weil, but some of them are a bit thick. And they, really nice ones. They will recommend stuff. So someone recommended this book that I should read the other day. And it was by one of these spiritual ladies who's just polyamorous and just loves all of these gods and has such great advice. But you know, the kind of writer who, I just really wanted to go to Guadeloupe and then I couldn't work out whether I should go to Guadeloupe. And then, oh my God, I walked past someone in the street and they were wearing a t-shirt that said Guadeloupe. And I went to Guadeloupe and I had my sister lent me the money and I had a great time. And that's supposed to be a spiritual path. Mm-hmm. And it's really bizarre. But I did think about these different people and I thought they might be dumb, but they are happy and they're happy because they're detaching from stuff. And I do think that they're hilarious, albeit unintentionally. Then I was reading this very serious piece by Simone Weil about the Lord's Prayer. And she said that in life we have to have an energy source. Technically it's bread, but that's not necessarily what feeds us each day. Some people are fed on ambition. Some people are fed on love. Some people are energized by different things. I think that we can be parasitical on other people, which is sort of what I was saying to you earlier. But this made sense to me. Simone Weil said it. And she said, when those things actually penetrate your core, so become more than a source, and they actually become part of you, if they're taken away, they can destroy you and kill you. And you should, that's why you should always have God as your source, because, but then she also says that affliction and suffering is about getting closer to God. She's probably right, James. She's a really interesting writer. I would read her over the Guadeloupe t-shirt lady.
What's the book I should read?
Waiting for God.
Waiting for God.
There are loads of them. Anything. Her, The Need for Roots, that's amazing. And the, especially right now, she's talked about the lie about Ham in Canaan. She said, anybody can say that a dog is bad and then hang the dog and then say more bad things about the dog, but we shouldn't listen to the excuses of the murderer. Well, have you ever heard a truer thing in your life? All the time at the moment, we're hearing, we're listening, we're being encouraged to listen to the excuses of murderers, as if they're valid. And the weirdest thing about the last few years is that it's like being dead and that no one can defend themselves because the truth is constantly being defamed. And the most hilarious thing about any of our chats is that people really take umbrage at my suggestion that the philosophy of turn the other cheek or the philosophy of nonviolence is obviously superior to the philosophy of violence. And if you don't believe that, essentially you are a slave because you can't possibly, or you want to be a slave master, because unless you believe ultimately that we can live without violence, then you are just part of an arms race towards total destruction or the total subjugation of your fellow man. There's literally nothing but violence is always going to win unless it's the inferior philosophy. Unless you genuinely believe that it's not the final solution, then you're going to succumb to it. Oh, I've got too serious. This is the problem. I've had such a nice time just reading books and writing jokes, and I'm miserable again.
And now you're just dumping. I tell you what, I worry slightly, Tanya, is that you're turning me into the Francis Foster character who just sits there going, yeah, I don't quite understand this, but yeah, whatever.
This means I'm being inarticulate. Sorry, Tanya.
No, you're not. You're great.
Yeah, video. Francis Foster, the song.
The song, yeah. It's quite good. So although what disappoints me with that song is it presupposes that you're that interested in what the Trigger Pod boys are up to or not up to. It's like they're a thing that they're worth discussing. And actually,
he's a very sweet chap though in real life, Francis. I've gigged with him since I started. When I started comedy, we used to gig together. And I was at a thing with him the other day, and he's a nice guy, and I don't watch this stuff, so I forget that he's successful.
Perfectly
he's totally
nice.
Sweet. And he didn't want to speak to me, really. And I thought, what? He's in a funny mood. Well, you know, being great friends, I wasn't one of those things where I'm like, oh. I just thought, oh, he's in a funny mood, isn't he? And then I realised later it's because I've been so rude about that podcast.
Can I tell you I don't know whether you're the right person to tell it, but I'm talking to you, so I'm going to tell it to you. Can I tell you an animal story?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a place opposite my bathroom. It's a kind of shed outbuilding where every year the swallows come to nest. And I always get so pleased when they come back, because every year I worry that the swallows, you know, this is like my Simon Vile thing, you know, like if the swallows don't come back, I die. Because I get so invested in, I think of the swallows going all the way to Africa and then flying all the way back and coming to the same spot. And presumably these are the children from previous broods of I don't know how long swallows live, but I've probably witnessed at least a couple of generations of swallows making their nests there. And it's great. And you watch their activity becoming more frantic as the eggs are about to hatch, and then you see them fluttering in and out nonstop, and you think, wow, it must be tough being a swallow when you're trying to feed your young. It's great watching them from the bathroom, and sometimes they land on the satellite dish outside the bathroom, and I see the red on their throats, the red and the white, and I love the swallows. Anyway, this year I saw this pair of jackdaws, and they were slowly building their jackdaw, twiggy, ginormous jackdaw nest. They were coming in and out, and I could see them on the roof, and hop, hop, hop.
Breaking a rolling.
And they're not stupid corvids, and sometimes they'd see me watching them, and then they'd look very specific. And I was worried that, I mean, I don't know what corvids eat, but I mean, they do, they pick out lamb's eyes and things, and they're not, I like them, but they're not the loveliest of, they haven't got the best of manners. And I was thinking, do my swallows, when they get back, do they really want to find a jackdaw nest in their nesting area?
Do you pay God and intervene?
So I did. I decided to play God and intervened. And I went in and destroyed their nest. And I was thinking, this nest is near to completion, and probably the female jackdaw is about ready to drop her eggs. And I've just gone and destroyed the nest where she was going to... I may have even destroyed her chances of producing these eggs. And I've killed some unborn jackdaw chicks. And a few days later I saw one of the jackdaws on the roof, and he was hopping around, and he had another twig in his mouth, and he was clearly trying to see, well, maybe I can still rebuild the nest. And he looked at me, and the look he gave me was, because they're not stupid, it was like, you bastard, I would never forget this. And apparently they don't forget now. And then this morning, I think I saw one of the swallows for the first time on the beginning of their nest-making journey, so it may have been worth it. Now, obviously you're not an ornithologist, so you can't really help me on this. You can't tell me whether the swallows would have made their nest in that place, even had the jackdaw nest been there, or whether I did the right thing by the swallows.
My son would be able to say.
What?
His whole time reading books on birds and watching birds, but I can't tell you, I'm afraid. I don't know.
I almost don't want to know the answer, because imagine if the answer was no, swallows love nesting next to the jackdaws. They would have been fine.
James, there is no answer. It's my friend's cat is always, unfortunately for the cat, he isn't that keen, but now too old and weak to escape. There's always being cuddled by the puppy. The puppy just sleeps next to the cat. You don't know. I don't understand why people are always looking for studies. That even if you could have removed those jackdaws, James, and even though no swallows before had ever nested next to a jackdaw, your swallows were going to be the first swallows in the history of time to nest next to a jackdaw. This idea that you can look it up and feel good or feel bad is nonsense. It's like that study about the lamb. You know, the one where the lamb can see the wolf, even though the lamb's protected from the wolf because it's in a cage, and just looking at the wolf, the lamb dies of fear. And on people on our side used to always share this study. Like, oh, look, you can make people die of fear. And I thought, well, the lamb was right to die of fear because it was in a cage with a sadist that was trying to frighten it to death. It did absolutely the right thing, just bowing out, frankly. Not that I think you should bow out in life. But I don't think you need a study.
That would be a
no
bit
answer.
Much, wouldn't it? If the result of this conversation was I went and topped myself because
no,
you'd kind of gently hinted that that's what I should do.
I don't mean you. I mean, if you're a lamb in the cage, the lamb should have been a bit bolder and just sucked up looking at that wolf every day. I just mean you don't know about the jackdaws and the swallows, but you didn't want them there. And now they're gone.
And as somebody else pointed out to me,
well, the jackdaws, foxes you've killed. Relax jackdaw. About the jackdaw.
Jackdaws have no problem finding places to nest. I mean, there's loads of jackdaw nests around me. See, this is what you're missing living in the city.
Honestly, yeah. I'm not. There's a pigeon that always tries to nest outside my greenhouse. I open the greenhouse door, the pigeon flies off.
And you've got your squirrel rats, I remember. Or whatever they
Don't
are.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Squirrel rats.
We have nesting blue tits. I'm moving anyway.
Are you moving to the country?
No, I don't know where I'm moving yet. And I won't be moving anywhere outside town for at least 2 years.
Okay. Can I tell you another animal story before we go? I was talking to this farmer about how one year one of his lambs, well, it happens all the time, one of his lambs got orphaned. And so he thought as an experiment, he'd see whether the lamb would feed on one of his cows, and because he had a dairy herd at the time, and so he put the lamb in with the cows, and sure enough the lamb was suckling on the cow's teats, and that I said, well, can you do that? Do lambs like cow's milk? He said, oh, the lamb was so healthy that a friend saw this lamb. And he said, what do you want for that lamb? And the chap thought a bit and said, well, if you pay me a pound more than you've just offered, he said, this was in the 60s when an extra pound was quite a lot. If you pay me a pound more, that lamb's yours. So the chap said, it's a deal. So he bought the lamb. 2 weeks later, the lamb was prancing up and down energetically in the field and then just went, it dropped dead because the cow's milk was so rich. It's given him a heart attack.
You know, I was just listening to you thinking of that interview clip that Owen Benjamin shared of Jordan Peterson and somebody, where he was talking about how they had so much breast milk stored for this surrogate baby that they'd adopted. And I was just thinking, well, because when I saw this clip, Owen Benjamin was very funny about it, but I was thinking, well, you don't just store 6 months of breast milk, because the whole point of breast milk is that it changes in its constitution according to the age of your baby. Your actual milk changes and gives different things to your baby. So you can't freeze it because it won't be the milk that they need in a month's time. That's just their body.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was listening to this, not to be disparaging about surrogacy.
You knew the lamb was going to die, didn't you? But even as I was halfway through the story, you knew it wasn't going to end well.
Yeah, I didn't think it was going to go well, but that not. I mean, hopefully it will for all those adopted children.
I have to go now. Do you know why? Even though I could talk to you forever, it's because we have a man called Richard who's like
Dick, brother.
No, Richard. He helps out in the garden, and he lives on the canal, and he has a dog called Buzz. And Richard, to my great delight, is another batshit crazy conspiracy theorist loon. So we have
you're switching me out.
And so we give him lunch. He likes to have his lunch at a certain time. I don't want to disappoint him. So
well, then that's good. I want to say though, James, that one of the things I wanted to talk about.
Yes, do
really important.
You can.
My friend Varvara Tarasova, she's a classical pianist. You can listen to her albums and stuff. She's a serious musician.
Yeah.
And I've arranged a concert for her in a teeny tiny salon. She does loads, but this is a place. You know, the last time I spoke to you, I was off to see a friend of mine play Prokofiev.
Yeah.
he was actually a student of hers. Anyway, this teeny tiny salon in Waterloo at the 1901 Arts Club, it's so intimate. It's about 40 people. I mean, there's hardly any tickets. And but it's such an amazing space to see someone excellent in because you're so close. And I said, do you want to do a concert before your baby? Because she's pregnant again. And she said, yes. So I booked it in for the 10th of June.
10th of June?
I'll be. Yeah. And what? I think everybody should see
her. I think more importantly, what's she playing? Is it stuff we know?
Well, I can't tell you what the encore is. I do know, but I've been playing so much music.
Can you hint at the programme?
Yes. Tchaikovsky, for certain. I've literally just typed up this programme and I can't remember it. This is like when you ask me what I play on the guitar. I went brain dead. I've been playing the piano all morning. She's teaching me.
Good.
Moonlight Sonata.
I've heard of that.
Which is really hard. It's amazing. So she's doing Debussy. It's online. The Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff in the encore. I wasn't supposed to say it.
What? The Prelude in C sharp minor? She's not going to be doing a whole piano concerto, is she, as an encore?
No, this no. It's an hour. One second.
Yeah.
This, I can't believe she's going to be, she won't be crossed because I won't tell her that I'm about to put it on my website. She only just sent me the thing and I put it in. I've got no reception because I'm so polite to you, I turned my thing off. I don't bloody know. What did she say she was doing? Oh, here we go. Okay, Sweet Bergamesque, the two arabesques, the Tchaikovsky's Seasons, and Opus 37A. Well, that is Opus 37A. Scarlatti.
And Scarlatti. Right.
But how do you pronounce it? I don't know. Scarlatti. I'm a bit ignorant.
That's how you pronounce Scarlatti. How else would you? Would it Scarlatti?
No, I don't mean. I just mean it's a bit sad, really, that I'm such a schmuck. But never too late to learn.
I don't think you are a schmuck. You're a smart cookie. Tanya, have you got any? I don't know when this goes out, but have you got any shows? The ones in the north.
Yeah, that's why.
Cheshire and where?
So we're doing two in the same day, one in Southampton and one in Chesham.
That'll be easy. Are you flying?
No, Alistair's driving and he's one of the few people I feel safe in the car with.
Well, because he's got God on his side, that's why.
No, because he's a good driver.
Is he? Well, probably the two go together. So what...
We're doing Leeds on the 15th of May. Everybody has to come to that. Leeds Hi-Fi Club on the 15th of May. And then on the 23rd, I think, we're doing Chesham and Southampton, Chesham at lunchtime, Southampton in the evening. We're doing London again in October. I'm going to put some dates in. I just hate admin so much, James. And
one of these days, yeah, likewise. One of these days, I will actually come and see you because I do think you are quite funny for a girl. And
yeah,
and
despite being a woman.
And
do you know, the first time in ages, I've been actually writing jokes that I think are hilarious, which hasn't happened for a while.
Well, that's good. That's good.
I've been having a good time.
Well done.
It's been a bit of
It's always nice getting your mojo. I had this long, long period where I just basically couldn't write. I think it was partly a health thing and partly a response to, I was kind of lightly traumatized by a bad podcast experience I had on somebody else's podcast. And
my
best friend. But I think you shouldn't give demons energy by feeding them with your, so I won't mention it, but I'm starting to feel glimmers of coming back. Maybe the recovering finger is part of it. It's nice.
Maybe the finger that wasn't recovering was part of the trauma.
It was. Oh, and also apparently there was a Mayan demon and a curse that had been put on me when I was 38. I don't know who. Don't know who did it.
I'm very curious about that because they believe this in, I don't want to be general, but my friend who married the Berber shepherd, they really believe that if someone puts a curse on you, it doesn't have any effect unless you're unless there's something that you're doing wrong yourself. But my friend, I don't know if I can tell that story.
Oh, it sounds good.
I can't. It's really excellent, James, and I'll tell you in private.
Okay. That's an incentive to come to either this event with Vivara Tasatova on the 10th of June. Tarasova. Okay. Or to come to one of your many dates around the country.
Just look on my website. It's the ones with Alistair. I don't bother advertising the clubs because the clubs can advertise themselves. But the ones with Alistair, especially Leeds, Chesham, Southampton, they're coming up soon. We need to do really well at those. He's so funny at the moment. He is.
Where is Chesham?
Good. I don't know, James.
No.
Alistair will tell me.
Sorry to the good people of Chesham that we don't know where you live. Great.
I don't know where London is, James.
No.
I'm fine here.
No. Right. Good.
But
I've enjoyed that as always. It's fine. It's good. I can just wind you up and you just go. It's great. Well done.
I thought I was enjoying a period of my life of silence.
Do you know the tragic thing there? If I am Francis, then you know who that makes you.
Francis's best guest ever when Constantine's away ill.
No. Not quite. But you were getting there. You are the Thunderbird's puppet himself. Which is,
imagine.
I know.
You knew that it was Nick that started up that podcast, Dixon. He used to do it with Francis. And I did the podcast when it was Nick and Francis, and then Nick couldn't do it anymore because he's quite a high level thinker, Nick.
Yeah.
He's just very much embraced in the system. I do think that's interesting. Do you know, I met the most extraordinarily intelligent person the other day that works in television, really gifted.
Yeah.
And they were saying how the policy where they were working was better than a policy somewhere else. And I thought, we don't understand because it's so complicated getting stuff made. And it's so easy to have the microphone taken away from you or to have your budget removed or to... There are so many hoops to go through if you want to be creative now and you're not just writing on your own, which is the best way to do things. But then how do you share things? The publishing industry is the same. It's all riddled with nonsense. But everyone has accidentally become a propagandist just by assuming that these ridiculous things are A, necessary, and B, will somehow reflect on the quality of the content if the human resources part of the idea is done correctly. It's really strange. It's why I would never have done GB News, but not for all of the reasons that people thought that I shouldn't do it for. I wouldn't do it because when I was offered all of those shows, they were normalising whether or not the vaccine should be given to children. And I didn't want to, it was murder and I wasn't going to be part of it. And my friend said, oh, but you can say that on my show. I said, the second I say it on your show, it will look like there's a conversation to be had. I don't want to be part of the illusion of a conversation about whether or not we should murder children. I don't want to be part of it as if it's, half, six of one, half a dozen of the other. I don't want to participate in it. But even there, they had all of this complete strange juxtaposition of politics. So you had to do tests every day and you had to wear masks, but you could also slag off the left. So all of these people thought that they were doing something different, but they were conforming to all of the things they ostensibly disagreed with in order to get their message out, not realizing that they are the message. How you comport yourself is the message. It's not, I have to do X, Y, and Z to be able to speak. It's that if I can't speak without doing those disgusting things, I won't speak. Which will obviously be very hard for me in the future.
Well done, sorry, Tanya. James. That was good. That was a good last little unexpected bit. Well done. Thank you. I've enjoyed that. You're great. Come back soon and we'll plug your things. And thank you.
And good luck. Let's have it.
Good luck with your move, whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Take care, Dave. Thanks,
okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Ooh,
a lot of you have very kindly been asking, what's the best way we can support you? So thank you for caring and thank you for wanting to support me. There is now a new, better way of supporting me. Some of you subscribe via Substack. Some of you are on Patreon. Some of you are even on Subscribestar. And those all work in their way. The problem is, I find. I mean, take Substack as an example. Substack has been a great community for like-minded folk, but it is heavily controlled by the enemy. They deboost people like me. They want normie voices. They don't want really alternative people being given any prominence. Plus, of course, they get a cut of your generous donations. So here's an idea. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct on my website at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The website's been running for quite a while, but thanks to my assistant Andrew, it's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out, and you can comment on the podcasts, and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Thank you, my sharklings. I love you all, but I love... You know, I'm not supposed to have favourites, but I do kind of extra love those of you who make the effort to support me, because without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So, thank you.